The rallying cry from Republican presidential candidates this week is an echo of Ronald Reagan's famous line that government is not a solution to our problem, government is the problem. It's a sentiment some publishers also subscribe to, and they are taking their cause to Capitol Hill. Welcome, everyone, to our special Friday feature in CCC's podcast series, Beyond the Book. My name is Chris Keneally, and every week we speak with the editors and reporters of Publishers Week for an early look at the news that publishers, editors, authors, agents, and librarians will be talking about when they return to work on Monday. Joining me first on the show, as always, is Andrew Albanese in New York at PW's office. Andrew is the features editor for Publishers Weekly. Andrew, welcome back to Beyond the Book.
Hey, Chris. Great to be here.
Well, we're happy to have you back with us, although, of course, it is Friday the 13th, so we want to really make sure you're very careful throughout the day. We don't want any injuries or anything like that. Don't walk under any ladders.
I always manage to stub my toe or something on Friday the 13th. No joke.
I just stay inside, you know. That's the best approach.
Good policy.
What have you got for us on Monday?
Well, as you mentioned, the election season is beginning to reach a full boil, and our main feature is going to look at the forthcoming political books this election year, so you'll definitely want to check that out. You might want to break out your Norwegian sweater as well. Our retailing section has a look at the publishing operation of retailer L.L. Bean, and yes, L.L. Bean has a publishing operation. In news, we're also going to take a look at the shifts in both outlet and format that took place in the third quarter, and it seems like we can't escape the shadow of e-tail or Amazon. Our soapbox this week is written by a bookseller who urges us all to examine Amazon's role in the bookselling ecosystem, and it's really a pretty great read.
Well, as I mentioned in the lead there, Andrew, publishers and politics are trying to mix up again. What's happening there?
Yes, so this week, an intense discussion kicked up over a bill introduced in Congress called the Research Works Act. It was introduced in the House on December 16th. Now, it's a very brief bill, but it would have very wide ramifications, as it would bar federal agencies from mandating that taxpayer-funded research be made freely available to the public. So a little background here. This bill is actually the second bill proposed by publishers, indeed all but written by publishers, that would bar public access mandates, and it comes on the heels of a 2008 mandate that was enacted by the National Institutes of Health. The NIH mandate, which is now in effect, requires that grantees, as a condition of getting their NIH funding, must deposit their final research articles in a government-run database to be made freely available to the public within 1 year. Now, academic publishers claim that the NIH mandate unfairly competes with their products, that it benefits from and it duplicates their efforts, and that ultimately it's going to cost their industry jobs. Proponents of public access mandates, meanwhile, and this includes scientists and librarians and the public, as you might imagine, especially patients' rights advocates, are appalled at publishers' efforts to block this. For one, they say taxpayers paid for this research, so they should have a right to access it. And now, thanks to the digital age, they can do so pretty easily. And for the creators, that is the scientific community, the research article is not the ultimate goal. You know, unlike novels or other books, these authors don't write for and generally are not paid, you know, in royalties. So what matters to them is that their research, you know, what matters most to them is what their research can accomplish. You know, they want it to be as widely available as possible, as cheaply as possible, because that furthers the aims of science. And this bill, they say, sacrifices what the scientific community wants and what's best for the public, all to protect a publishing industry that arose to serve their interests in the first place. So we're going to have a lot more on this in the coming weeks, including editorials from both sides of the issue. But I'll offer this analysis right now. You know, you have to wonder why publishers would push this bill at this time. You know, they're being beaten up on editorial pages all over for their support of the Stop Online Piracy Act, SOPA, as we know it. And, you know, let's face it, barring public access isn't exactly a populist stance. And this bill really has absolutely zero chance, or I'll say very little chance, of actually going anywhere. So why? Why jump on this PR bandwagon right now? Well, I think the bill represents publishers deciding that a good offense is probably the best defense. Recently, the White House solicited comments on public access, and last year, Congress proposed a bill that would do the opposite of the Research Works Act. It would actually mandate that all taxpayer-funded research be made publicly available for major agencies anyway. So perhaps introducing a competing bill might be a way to keep a stalemate in place, you know, to keep that NIH mandate from spreading to other agencies. And I would also add that, you know, this very, very brief language, I could see it being slipped into another copyright reform bill or even a spending bill. You know, that's unlikely, but it's worth watching.
Well, Andrew, you've only mentioned Amazon once so far. I think there's a couple of other times you can do it during this episode as well, right?
Oh, at least two more.
Yeah, so because we expect it from you. It's Amazon. This is becoming Amazon show.
Well, you know, there were two interesting developments out of Amazon this week. One, remember last month we talked about Amazon's KDP program, which offered authors and publishers a chance to share in a pool of funds generated by the Kindle owner's lending library. Well, surprise, Amazon says that program has been so successful in its first month that they're increasing the amount of the fund authors can share to $700,000 this January from $500,000 last December. Amazon reported that the top 10 earners made over $70,000 in December, with one author, Carolyn McRae, banking over $8,000, and another, Rachel Yu, who's a 16-year-old author of a children's book, banking over $6,000. So let's see you do that babysitting, right? But not so fast, because at PW, we've also been hearing directly from people using the program who aren't quite as pleased. One author detailed her experience for us and noted that, you know, while she was, you know, expecting to make about $1,000 based on the number of borrows and buys that she saw, she instead got a check for less than $10 after everything was parsed out. Still, she wasn't exactly sure what to make of the program. Clearly, it offered some promotional benefit, she surmised. But you know, ultimately, she noted that its requirement of exclusivity probably made it a bad bet. So we'll be keeping an eye on that program, and we'll probably have a more full report on it later in the year. And the other thing that was sort of attention-getting from Amazon this week was that Nancy Pearl, who like many like to call America's favorite librarian, including me, and she's a PW columnist that I'm happy to work with, this week announced a deal with Amazon to bring long-forgotten and out-of-print books back into the market with a series called Book Lust Rediscoveries. The series is going to publish 6 books a year in print editions via Amazon Publishing. They'll also be available as audiobooks via Amazon and also Audible.com. And according to Amazon, they're also going to be available nationally in bookstores, through wholesalers, and available to libraries. And, of course, they're going to be available as Kindle editions as well. And if that's not enough, a good deed to just put out-of-print books back into circulation, she's also donating a portion of the proceeds to the Library School at the University of Washington. But in a sign of just how deep this anti-Amazon sentiment runs, we're already hearing a lot of complaints from indie booksellers and librarians who are expressing nothing short of outrage that Nancy Pearl would do a deal with this evil empire that is known as Amazon. And some are even threatening to cut ties with her. And some librarians are even saying that they've been, quote-unquote, betrayed, all of which I think is a little hysterical. You know, for indie booksellers, few people have been better evangelists for reading, and few people have devoted their lives to the health of the book world as Nancy Pearl has. You know, just think how many books Nancy Pearl sells or circulates for indie bookstores and libraries. And for libraries to be this upset, like, let's take a moment and think about this. Are you really going to throw Nancy Pearl out of the lifeboat over a deal to take 6 books a year from the grave and give them new life? You know, the traditional publishing and bookselling industries have utterly failed these authors. You know, these authors did their jobs. They wrote great books, but they were unable to get support from their publishers or their booksellers. So am I to understand now that some librarians would prefer these books continue to be totally unavailable than to be published with Amazon? I just don't understand that reaction. Now, should we be concerned with some of Amazon's practices? Absolutely, no question. And you and I seem to be talking about those concerns on a regular basis. But for librarians who can't believe that Nancy would support Amazon, I'd take a moment to remind them that libraries are currently supporting traditional publishers that are refusing to lend ebooks, that are supporting bills like SOPA, the Research Works Act, which we're just talking about, that are suing libraries over fair use and supporting DRM and lockdown licenses and low royalty rates for authors, and publishers that have all but abandoned poetry and first fiction. So, you know, I applaud anyone who wants to work for the future of a vibrant book business. But before we put a target on Nancy Pearl, you know, I think we should all just take a deep breath.
Well, you know, the situation you describe, Andrew, reminds me of what my grandfather used to say, no good deed goes unpunished.
Indeed.
Well, thank you for that, Andrew Albanese, PW's features editor. Now I want to turn, as we do every week, to Rose Fox, a PW Reviews editor who blogs at Genreville. Welcome back to Beyond the Book, Rose.
Thank you, Chris.
It's good to have you back with us on this Friday the 13th. What kinds of books have you brought for us? Anything here that's going to bring us good luck?
Well, I hope so. We have a poetry section this week. I personally feel that poetry is always good luck, and we're highlighting Regan Good's The Atlantic House, which is a big yet concise book that's both romantic and contemporary in its approach, and Gibson Faye LeBlanc's Death of a Ventriloquist, which raises important questions about how we perform ourselves through language. We have Q&As this week with Hari Kunzru discussing his novel Gods Without Men, which he says is a novel where meaning is always draining away into silence and absence, and with Owen Lokanen, author of The Professionals, who talks about how his career as a poker journalist influenced his novel writing. In fiction, we cover Deborah Kopagan-Kogan's The Red Book, which our reviewer calls a smart, funny, engrossing, and action-packed meditation on women's lives, and Waiting for Sunrise by William Boyd, which is an absorbing spy novel set in 1913 Vienna.
Well, you have several of these historical spies appearing in the issue this week.
Yes, they're all over the place, this issue. No surprise, there's some in the mystery thriller section. We cover Archive 17 by Sam Eastland, a Stalin-era Soviet Union novel set in a Siberian labor camp, and The Man Who Killed by Fraser Nixon, a liquor smuggling mystery set in 1926 Montreal. Maybe more of a surprise is that we have historical spies and romance, too. We review Mary Jo Putney's No Longer a Gentleman, in which an English secret agent is sent to rescue another spy from Napoleonic-era France, and Touch of a Rogue by Mia Marlowe, a 19th-century supernatural investigation. Straddling the border between genres, we review two books by Joe R. Lansdale, Edge of Dark Water, which is a brand new thriller set in Depression-era East Texas, and Act of Love, his debut horror novel, now reprinted and just as powerful as it was in 1980. In science fiction, fantasy, and horror, we highlight another horror debut, The Games, by Ted Kosmatka, which is a superbly gripping story of an insane artificial intelligence that designs a monster to compete in the Olympics. We also cover The Drowning Girl by Caitlin R. Kiernan, a finely crafted standalone fantasy in which a young woman struggles to discern between hallucinations and the truly supernatural. In comics, we have The Silence of Our Friends, a graphic novel written by Mark Long and Jim DeMonicos, and illustrated by Nate Powell, which tells the story of two families, one white and one black, who witness and participate in the protests, violence, and struggle of the 1960s American South.
Well, you know, love of language is something that kind of goes with the territory when it comes to authors, and I understand in nonfiction you've got two books on language this week.
We do. We have The Story of English in 100 Words by David Crystal, which is a delightful history of the words we use and some we've forgotten and how we came to use them. And we also have Trip of the Tongue, Cross-Country Travels in Search of America's Language by Elizabeth Little, which is a combination travelogue and linguistic field log. We also cover David K. Shipler's Rights at Risk, The Limits of Liberty in Modern America, which is a fascinating and provocative book. And there's a lifestyle section this week, which includes a review of Ted Allen's In My Kitchen, in which the Food Network host focuses on the pleasures of slow food. In children's books, we cover 11 crafty concept books that help children tackle colors, numbers, manners, and more. The children's fiction section highlights The Boy on Cinnamon Street by Phoebe Stone, a dark middle grade mystery. And Chitty Chitty Bang Bang Flies Again by Frank Cottrell Boyce, illustrated by Joe Berger and commissioned by the heirs of Sir Ian Fleming. And believe it or not, our reviewer says this sequel, which is the first of a planned trilogy, actually outsigns the original Chitty Chitty Bang Bang. So that's a pretty high mark to reach, and I'm very much looking forward to that. We also have a great review of The Fault in Our Stars by John Green, which is a highly anticipated young adult novel about two teen cancer survivors. And finally, in the children's religion and spirituality section, we cover Joyce Meyer's Every Which Way to Pray, a refreshingly unpreachy children's book illustrated by Mary Sullivan, and Interrupted, A Life Beyond Words by 15-year-old debut author Rachel Coker, I'm impressed, who writes an emotionally compelling and psychologically nuanced story of an adopted girl in Maine during Depression and the World War II.
Well, thanks as always, Rose, for that roundup. And, you know, if you ask me, it's good luck anytime an author gets a review in Publishers Weekly, and especially true on Friday the 13th. Rose Fox, PW Reviews editor who blogs at Jarmerville, thank you.
Anytime.
And Andrew Albanese, as always, good to have you back. We look forward to returning yet again next Friday for our usual Friday feature from Beyond the Book, PW's Week Ahead.
Thanks, Chris. Happy Friday the 13th to you.
All right. Well, I'm going to be, as I say, kind of hiding out in my office here, just getting my work done and staying away from all the temptations and the terrors that are out there. Beyond the Book is produced by Copyright Clearance Center, a global rights broker for the world's most sought-after materials, including millions of books and ebooks, journals, newspapers, magazines, and blogs. You can follow Beyond the Book on Twitter, like Beyond the Book on Facebook, and subscribe to the free podcast series on iTunes or at our website, copyright.com/beyondthebook. Our engineer is Jeremy Briskey of Burst Marketing. My name is Christopher Keneally. For all of us at Copyright Clearance Center, thanks for listening to Beyond the Book.